This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and today I'm talking with Splitting the Sky. Splitting the Sky is a political activist and powerful speaker for 9/11 Truth, a public speaker, an author, an actor, a carpenter, and a Mohawk warrior who has been involved in some of the most important political standoffs of the 20th century, including the Attica Rebellion in New York State in the 1970s and the Gustavson Lake standoff in BC in the 1990s. Splitting the Sky, thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
It's good to be here with you, James.
Well, it's excellent to have you here. And as I think that introduction makes clear, you've already led quite a remarkable life. Why don't you tell us in your own words about your background and some of your formative experiences?
Well, I guess my story starts out as a youth who was abducted by state authorities in Buffalo, New York. Abducted from my mother, who was a single Native Mohawk woman living in the slums of Buffalo, New York on Potomac Avenue. And I guess the New York State Child Welfare Department just had abducted me and my sisters and took us and put us into foster homes. And eventually I was put into a residential school type setting. And from there, I had pretty much fought off numerous attacks, sexual attacks and beatings against me, and was one that sort of acquired an attitude as a boy that out of my fear and terror that was struck into me at any given time, you know, I vowed as I got bigger and stronger that I would resist this form of atrocities that were committed by these people that ran these institutions. I became pretty much institutionalized for my whole life, and the more I resisted, the more they threw me before a psychologist and tried to label me as incorrigible and antisocial and the like. And as I was getting older, I was getting stronger, but I was getting much more angry at the institutionalizations, to be having been abducted from my family and feeling totally abandoned, and doing my own psychological analysis, you know, psychological analysis, being able to think and have to look at my realities, you know, on a day-by-day basis and analyze it and do it on my own. And the older I got, the more I tried to teach myself and educate myself. But I was always getting into conflicts with authority. And before you know it, I found myself in reform schools. And eventually I left the New York State Reform School from upstate New York and Rochester. And when I was sort of hit the street with no skills, and I took to, you know, it was the end of the 60s, and I was kind of like, during the anti-war movement, and I started meeting people, you know, from the women's movement, anti-war movement, you know, the rise of the black resistance movement and Indian pride movement in our communities in Buffalo and stuff. But again, I had no work, and I did odd jobs and pretty much slept in hallways and on the, in park benches and stuff like that. It was in pretty bad shape. And so I got to drinking and drugging, and one night out of desperation, instead of sleeping in a 30 below zero weather, I attempted a robbery. It was the only crime of my life. And I bungled that robbery and had nothing, and was sentenced to 8 years in prison for an attempted robbery. And was told by a judge that, red niggas like you, deserve to do your whole life in jail. And so he gave me eight years. And so that started my sojourn in the New York State penal system. And as I was in there, I became affiliated with quite a few people who were politically active, a lot of people that had been members of the Weather Underground, people that, excuse me, people who had been Black Panthers and the Muslim Party and, Puerto Rican Young Lords and, white social activists, anti-war activists. And so I found that, you know, through trial and error, that when it's a survival all of those years in the penitentiary, that the only way that you can do that is really to keep your sanity and to try to build your mind, your body, and your spirit and try to become conscious of what's going on in the world, and instead of being victimized and also just doing there and being a conscious, I decided to develop my personality. I was motivated by people like Martin Luther King that I seen on TV and Malcolm X and people that took righteous stance and various activists that I was seeing, you know, news reports and stuff, on the television, which was our only medium to the outside world. And of course then there was a serious censorship that was going on in the penitentiary, so you really couldn't get the kind of books you needed to read. But what happened was there was like sort of an underground network. There was people like I buddied up with one of the other underground guys, Sam Melville, who was known as the Mad Bomber, but this guy was really a brilliant man. He used to walk around with his sort of, I'm going to call it a cape, but it was sort of like his bedroll, you know, his blanket, and used to kind of wear that around him, and it was chilly outside, and his coat. But he and I used to play chess, and I was a chess fanatic, and also, you know, building my body by lifting weights and things. And this was at Attica, and it was only there 16 days before the rebellion blew. And what pretty much happened is you know, that Melville was basically teaching many, many inmates that, you know, that we were more political prisoners and victims of vicious economic systems and social structures, and was laying out a whole lot of the Marxist-Leninist type consciousness, you know, the philosophies. And so as a young Native guy, I was pretty angry, but giddy, very strong. I was a very angry young man because I'd been totally abused in so many situations, and so I found myself striking out. So it was easy to incorporate me into revolutionary politics and of that time, and there was a lot of that was going on. There was an authoritarian movements that were challenging, man, the status quo, and taking issue, man, with issues nationally and internationally. And of course, then I began to really study. You know, I was totally blown away by material like, you read Dee Brown's "Bury My Heart, a Wounded Knee," and then I started reading, checking out many other different Native authors, and starting to become an activist, man, an identity search for my search as an indigenous person, a Mohawk Cree. And so there's my search for identity, you know, continued to grow. And as a matter of fact, I've actually written an autobiography called "The Autobiography of Dr. Julie Over Splitting the Sky, From Attica to Gustafson Lake." And with my partner, who's a Cree Indian woman from Manitoba, Churchill, Manitoba, and her name is Shekeefstador, Sandra Bruger. And so we authored a 650-page autobiography, and I'm discussing in detail this whole transitional development. But what happened was when I got to Attica, where my story really begins, where my eyes really became open to the realities of totalitarian police state, if you will. And what pretty much happened was is that the penal conditions were so decrepit. I mean, rats are running around in your cell, and you lived on 62 cents per day per capita. The diet was pork fat and rancid meats and mostly starts and sugars. And you know, you only got, you work in the prison sweatshops for like 2 cents a day. You know, you work for 6 days a week, one shower a week, and you had to bird bath all the other times. And there was just, and literally the prison administration was run by local Klansmen. They were run by neo-Nazi conservatives, and they were, as a matter of fact, the warden of the Attica prison, Vincent Mancusi, was rumored, beyond rumor, actually, to be the Grand Imperial Wizard of the local Clarin in Attica. And so these guys used to, without any sort of exaggeration, all these guys would literally run the prison with complete authoritarian regimentation, and they used to run operate. You couldn't speak at all, and you couldn't talk at all. And if you were caught talking, you were pulled out of a line. And you were beaten over the head and bludgeoned to death and left to die, and they would drag you off with your brains just spilt all over the floor so that the inmates would see that that the niggers were not tolerated. They used to call their guard stick, they used to call them nigger sticks. And so they'd beat people to death, and then they'd bury them in unmarked graves and say that they committed suicide or escaped. And so these atrocities, I'd seen a number of people murdered in cold blood right before my eyes, beaten to death by guards. And you were told that if you were congregated any more than three at a time in a yard, that you would be, that you would be taken to solitary confinement. And when they told you go to solitary confinement, it usually meant that you got lost in the system and you never seen them again. So there were outright murders that were committed then, and I'm sure they're still committed by the hundreds and thousands of people are murdered on a monthly basis. Hundreds are murdered at any given time in the United States penal system, especially since the penal system has been privatized. Now, at that time, there was like 750,000 prisoners in the U.S. penal system. Today, there's 2.3 million because of the privatization of the prison system. So. That said, there was a guy by the name of George Jackson out of San Quentin. He was in, I believe it was Folsom Prison, or Soledad Prison, and he was a political activist and a great writer. He wrote, George Jackson, Letters from Prisons, and Blood in My Eyes, and he really was a troubadour for resistance, and he had the kind of fire that I started reading his books, and I was totally mesmerized by his ability to identify the prison class and the need to resist. And he was also, I guess, Angela Davis had fallen in love with him, and there was a big prison escape. And Jonathan Jackson, George Jackson's brother, tried to break him out. And Jonathan Jackson was killed in the melee, a judge was. And some other political prisoners, Rochelle McGee and others, were, Fleeter Grumgo, were indicted for the attempted escape. Well, George Jackson was then going on a visit one day, and or something happened, and they shot him to death like on August the 21st in 1971. This was just days before Attica. It was really one of the incidents that led to the Attica Rebellion. And so what happened basically was this, when they said that he had a .38 snub nose and was trying to escape, inside of his afro, and he was trying to escape from prison. Of course, they shot him up numerous times. I think it was 20-some times. And they murdered him. Well, when we heard that, we had a solidarity, prayer in the yard. Everybody, man, was shocked when they heard that this valiant black political prisoner, had been murdered. At the same time, I was kind of had heard about the killing of another guy named Dickie Oates, who led was a Mohawk, who led a rebellion. Or led the walk on to Alcatraz, the seizure of Alcatraz Island, and so so we're becoming familiarized with the political abductions and assassinations that were going on, and when they killed George Jackson, we started holding a unanimous group prayer, and so everybody wore white shirts and a black armband, went out into the middle of the yard, and we went there to. to say solidarity, united prayers with one another, instead of everybody being regimented into different races and classes, and you know, everybody being divided and conquered, you know what I mean, instead of in a segregated form, institutionalized segregation. But so we all came together, and this totally freaked the guards out, because like you're not any more than three at a time. You know, they moved in to start pounding people and beating people to death. But there was everybody unanimously in a yard. Hundreds of us came together, and we said the solidarity prayer. Another incident happened about a week later. A white guy and a black guy were scrimmaging for a football game, and this guard by the name of Maroney, lieutenant, came out to the yard and said that, lock that nigger up. And so what happened was the black guy, when they went to arrest him and put him in solitary confinement, started punching out the lieutenant. At that point, a bunch of us all raised up, and we all circled in solidarity to defend this guy. So in other words, we weren't being intimidated by the fear of being killed anymore. We were starting to smell the necessity to unite and to resist. And so we did that, and we did that pretty valiantly, with a lot of fearlessness at that point. We were losing our fear because it was necessary. It was time. It was time to take issue with the kind of, again, I say, Abu Ghraib and Bagram and Guantanamo Bay had nothing on Attica State Prison or any of the prisons of the state and federal prisons in the United States. So it's not a new thing what's happened here. You know, post-Bush administration, so during the Bush administration. What happened, it has been going on for a very long time. And we actually sort of broke the spell on that for a period by resisting the Attica. Well, they locked those brothers up. Next day, everybody just completely refused. The word got around. They had taken some brothers out of their cell that night, those guys, and they locked them up. And they set a number of fires in their different prison wings and stuff like that. And that next morning when they were trying to get us, they usually go out to the yard, you know, and a half an hour before your prison assignment, your slave assignments. And basically what happened was everybody had said, hey, we're not gonna eat. We're just gonna be silent and refuse to eat. So 99% of the people there refused to eat. Everybody picked up the plates, the silverware, sat down, said nothing, and there was 400 guards inside there, and they were basically, they were so afraid, you could hear their keys shaking. They were trembling. They were just shaking. And so anyways, we're all going back to our units, and they had locked the outside doors. And so one of the guards were coming up, and one of the guys from the Panther Party had asked why they locked those two brothers up the night before. And the guard says, well, we don't know the fellas. And at that point, the Panther started pounding on the guards. And before you know it, that was it. We turned around, and we all yelled out, this is it. Take the prison, and it exploded. And in a matter of an hour, we had seized 50 hostages, and put them into inmate clothing. We had ravaged 1 mile square of a prison, and we held that prison in one yard. We seized everything out of the commissary. We seized bedding and clothing and stuff, and we got into one yard. We held them as hostages to call attention to the world, and we were fortunately able to get ABC, NBC, and CBS, national TV, in there to document on a day-by-day. We called in for very prominent people like Ramsey Clark or William Kunstler and State Senator John Dunn and Assemblyman Arthur O. Even a whole bunch of prominent people, Tom Wicker of the New York Times. We were able to get them in as observers to negotiate the prison conditions, and there ended up being 28 demands that we put together, but some of those demands seemed to be too reformist, and a lot of us were more sovereigntist and self-determined, and our plight. And so we basically said, the hell with this, you know, we're not here, man, to make prison life, to make it all happy, you know, to make it a pleasant experience. This is prison life, man, is a result, man, between the have and the have-nots. And it wouldn't exist, man, if the haves, man, weren't exploiting the rest of the world's population, man, and controlling and putting people in jail, man, for the conditions that they create for people to survive. So in most of the crimes in the U.S. penal systems are property related. 75% of them are property related. So in any event, at that time, some of us says, hey, well, we demanded release from that prison. We wanted a helicopter to be flown out of Attica and flown into a country to be accepted into a country as political prisoners, and we wanted political asylum to any country that would accept. Well, there were 17 countries that said that they would take us. Right, and they were heard worldwide. And but at that point, Rockefeller said, mobilize the forces and send them in. So on September the 13th, that morning, after negotiating for 5 days, they locked the negotiators out, and they cut off the water, and a helicopter flew over the building that night or that afternoon on September the 13th, and as it flew over, it started dropping canisters of CN4 gas, a gas that was banned by the Geneva Convention in 1906 as cruel and unusual a form of torture and pain that was used in Vietnam. So they banned it in Vietnam, but they kept it in the National Guards kept it in their vaults to be deployed against prisoners. They dropped 5 canisters of that gas, and then there was 1,000 state troopers that were lined up, that were up on top of the roofs, and, the 1,000 state troopers started firing over 60,000 rounds of bullets in 5 minutes. Within that time, there was, all you could see was gas, tracer bullets. Every fifth bullet was a tracer, a red fluorescent bullet, and then you just heard the screams of people being murdered in a cold-blooded massacre. I started losing my vision, and I ran out of this building up on the catwalk and ran into a state trooper with his gun, shotgun, right in my face, and he pulled the trigger on me. The clip fell out. So he is wearing a gas mask, and it was raining that morning, but he was getting rain gear and a gas mask, and another trooper, you could see both our eyes just went wide, and my eyes went wide with my hands up in the air, and the other trooper hit me across the mouth and knocked me over this tier, 30 foot down onto a handball court where I almost broke my back and went unconscious from a concussion on my head. And when I woke up, there were prisoners that were being shot right around me. One guy's head was blown off right there and sprayed blood all over me and everybody else around, and the guts were spilling, and there was troopers had taken inmates and were putting them inside the latrines and sticking guns up their ass and blowing their insides out. And they were putting it right up against them and calling them all kinds of niggers and calling everybody a nigger and says, this is our day. You had yours. This is our days. You're a bunch of dead niggers. And so then they made people crawl around, and they crushed up glass and they put it in the hallways, and they made people strip naked. And they made people run through the halls on broken glass, and they were beating people over the head and in the testicles, and they threw soap on the marble floor so that when you hit the naked, you would fall and you'd slide, and they'd beat you, and you'd get cut from all the glass, and then they threw you back into the cells. Well, there was people that were tortured to death. Some guys had hot shotgun shells put on their forehead. One guy had a cigar put between his testicle and his legs and told that if he moved it, that they would blow his balls right off. They committed atrocities, unbelievable murders, and to this day, not one state trooper is indicted.
That is just an incredible story and an incredible travesty of justice. And I think many of my listeners will know how that turned out. Eventually, you were to be the only person convicted in that rebellion, that uprising at Attica State.
That's true.
And in 1979, you were eventually released.
Yes, I was.
And so going from that point, how did you come to relocate to B.C.?
Well, I was I became active in the American Indian Movement, and I was one of the coordinators, the regional coordinators for the American Indian Movement in Maryland. I moved down to Maryland after an incident. I had gotten out on parole and had violated, had an incident in Washington Square Park in New York City. And I had been attacked, and I defended myself, but then I was seen as the aggressor in this this attack against me. In any event, I went back for about 90 days. Ramsey Clark, my attorney, got me back out on the streets, and I started mobilizing two things. I started coordinating, become one of the regional directors for the American Indian Movement, as well as I founded an organization called the League of Indigenous Sovereign Nations. LISN was the acronym. And I mobilized a massive demonstration of 10,000 people for the 500-year anniversary of Columbus in 1992. 1993, well, there was about 10,000 people there, and then we really kicked off and launched the campaign to unite all sovereign indigenous nations into one great confederation, similar to the quest that was done by Daganoweda, the prophet and statesman of the Iroquois people, the people of the Haudenosaunee people. And so basically, in 1993, there was a conference that was being conducted up here in Edmonton, Alberta. One of the AIM leaders at that time had been asked to come up and make a presentation on Indigenous self-determination in Edmonton, and that was Vern Bellecourt. He couldn't make it up, so he had told one of the organizers in Edmonton to contact me, see if I was available. Well, I told him I would come up and make a presentation on the League of Indigenous Sovereign Nation. And as I was up here, I saw probably one of the most beautiful women that ever lived, named Sandra Bruder. She keeps the door, and she's Cree from Manitoba. And it was instantaneously hit with a thunderbolt, and we fell in love, and that's how I came to Canada.
Incredible.
I decided to leave New York rather than for have her to come to New York. I decided, well, there's really nothing much left in New York. I'll come up to Canada. And so I've been here ever since 1993.
I see. And then, of course, there was the Gustavson Lake standoff in 1995, I believe.
And yes, as... Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, I'd love to have you on about that in the future to talk about that. But today I'd like to move on to more recent events. I'd like to talk a little bit about your 9/11 truth activism and how find out how and why you became interested in 9/11 truth.
Well, basically what happened was I was actually invited by a nephew of the Rockefellers by the name of Will O'Neill. He had seen a video that we had done on Gustavson Lake and about the standoff in 1995, and somehow he had gotten this in New York. There was another friend of mine who's a world-renowned violist, a brother by the name of Avon, that introduced me to this young fellow, and he's out of Seattle. But what happened was... I had finished the autobiography, and this young fellow offered to bring me to New York to launch a book launching campaign in New York City. And, of course, I lived in New York City for quite a few years. I actually lived with my lawyer, Ramsey Clark, there for about 3 months when I first got out of prison in May of 1979. What happened, I got there, when I was talking and discussing this guy, I saw the video from Gustavson Lake, and was also definitely knew about Attica, because his uncle was, he wanted to sort of help, you know, you know, help me to try to maybe clear some of his uncle's name or something. I'm not totally sure what it was. For him, it was some kind of spiritual sojourn he was on, and he wanted to help me to alleviate his Rockefeller's karma. But I'm not so sure if that ever how that ever panned out. But that's pretty much at his invite. We discussed dates to do that. Now, this would have been the 30th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion / massacre that was perpetuated by New York State Police, who to this day have never been indicted for any charges out of Attica for outright murders and tortures they committed. What happened? Well, we were discussing. He says, "Well, how about September the 15th?" I said, "Well, yeah, okay, that sounds good. Then that's 2001. I said, "Well, yeah, it sounds like a good date." And then I thought about it, and I called him back, and I said, "You know something? I said, why don't we do the benefit concert on September the 9th, which would be exactly 30 years to the day we took Attica." And then he said, "Okay, good." So there was a place called SOBs. In the village, and there was a couple of performers that were going to donate their talent. And now, as I had the books would have been ready, and he put up the cost for our transportation to get there. And also, while I was out there, I began a real spiritual journey through the practice of the Sundance, and I became a Sundance chief. And so there was a Sundance that was happening in August, so just before there, so we're going to go to the Sundance and then go up and do this thing in New York, this benefit to launch the book campaign. So we did the Sundance, and it was my 16th Sundance by that time, so that was the last year I Sundanced. And I went up to New York with the family, and this guy put us up in the World Trade Financial Center, which was a block and a half from the Twin Towers. But he put us up in rooms, right, in that financial center. It would cost less because they were doing major renovations throughout the whole building there, rather than the Marriott, which was right next to the Twin Towers. Now, we got there, and by the time we were there, like 10 days in advance, and the family and I were going in and out. We were actually had thought to go up the Twin Towers to go to the top of there and see what the world was like. But I kept getting this creepy feeling about it. And so I told my family, well, they should go up in the top of the Empire State Building instead, of course. I had this weird feeling about Twin Towers. And we do the gig. The gig went pretty well, and lots of people were there. And by the 10th, September the 10th, we were told that we could stay there a few more days, as we wanted, to wean out easy. But I did have a talk that I was supposed to give at McGill University in Quebec, and I was going to visit my sister in Buffalo and on the way up. So I figured we'd take off. But I was getting a real creepy feeling, so was my wife and our kids, and so we decided, man, just to take off on the 10th. It's like all of a sudden we just had this total inclination to get the hell out of New York. And so we left New York, and by the time we got all the way to Quebec, 4 o'clock the next morning, the Mohawk Reserve over there, Kahnawake, with a friend of ours named Continetta. And so that's when we heard the hot towers were hit the next morning. Well, the funny thing about it is the building that we were in on the 26th floor, 400 people died in that same building the next morning when those towers came down. We could have been dead, so we could have been casualties there. So from that point on, that totally tweaked my interest as to, well, what the hell really went on. And that began my search and research, and I've been researching for 8 years, almost 8 years now straight, the intricacies of what happened behind 9/11. And my total research has led me to conclude, and the many talks that I've been giving as of the last year, that 9/11 was an inside job. and 9/11 was conducted not by Muslims from Arab countries, but it was conducted by both the Mossad, the CIA, the British SAS, and the Pakistani ISI. And I've laid out all the particulars in many of my talks, which can be heard on www.splittingthesky.net.
So, Splitting the Sky, I'm not sure if you follow the Corbett Report podcast, but something that I've stated on the podcast before is that I think there's too much attention placed on the physical anomalies of 9/11 and not nearly enough research done on the financial transactions that underpin 9/11. And just as any criminal investigator is told to follow the money, I think that anyone interested in 9/11 should be on the money trail. And from what I've read of your work, I think we're on the same page here. In your own words, how important is it to follow the 9/11 money trail?
Well, first of all, James, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was my very first inclination after the shock and awe of this, of what I consider a corporate black operation. After seeing those buildings go down and 3,000 people, various nationals from many countries all around the world, including Canada, Japan, Germany, and all around the world, people that were murdered on that day, what we saw that day was nothing less than a super snuff film. And from that moment, I mean, when I saw 3,000 people killed on that morning and thought to myself, well, my family and I could have been there, we could have been victims of that supersized snuff film. And that when I thought about this, I said to myself, it's not going to be that hard to find out, can't be that hard to find out who actually committed this atrocity. And then, but I thought it was kind of weird from the very onset that you see a person by the name of Jerry Hauer talking to Dan Rather and just automatically stating from the onset that it was an operation that had the fingerprints of Osama bin Laden. And I thought, well, wait a minute. And also, my own sense of logical conclusions told me that when those buildings fell, those were controlled demolitions. And those were the physical aspects that one automatically has to trust your own senses. And that's elementary architectural structure or knowledge in architectural structure. And just by everyday, scenes of demolitions of buildings being imploded, around the world. My brother was one of the foremen on the Twin Towers during the process of the towers going up. He was the foreman for one of the major Mohawk crews that are skyscrapers, that are known for building skyscrapers and bridges and the like, because we don't have the fear of heights. And I know for a fact that in talking with one of my brothers there, that there was no way he could believe that it imploded and that it fell because as a result of aircraft. It's just, it was built and designed to withstand that kind of impact. And so I thought automatically, I thought something was terribly wrong. So to me, it was obvious when I had heard not too long after that, that there had been these put option stocks that were traded on Wall Street prior to 9/11. Well, automatically that told me that if somebody was gambling that various corporations were going to fall the share values, man, of these corporations were going to rise as a result of this 9/11 attack. I started investigating who those corporations were. I found out initially that these corporations had been listed on the Securities Exchange Commission, but then were banned from release and taken off the internet in the U.S. The Securities Exchange Commission in Canada had also released the information, and there was a writer in Vancouver, British Columbia, by the name of Ian Mulgrew, who printed some of the corporations that benefited from multi-billion dollars in put option trades. Now, I thought to myself, well, this is going to be easy enough to find. I mean, it's going to be no problem. I mean, that's elementary investigative units could find out who traded and who were the beneficiaries, who were the people that refused to pick up the millions in unclaimed put option stock tradings. There was indication already on the internet that the third man in control of the CIA, Buzzy Krongard, was one of the beneficiaries of millions of dollars of put options trading, which automatically implicates the CIA in this operation. And so as I began to look further into it, and in this article done by Ian Mulgrew, I find out that within the next couple of days, they took that off the internet, and they took it off the archives of the Vancouver Sun. Well, the thing about it is I looked at this some more. I had wrote down all of the 30 corporations that benefited from the put option trades. To the tune of billions of dollars. And then there were 30 corporations from the Bank of America to the Lehman Brothers. Hello? Yeah, to Lehman Brothers, to Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Bear Stearns, AIG. Do any of these corporations do sound familiar, don't they?
They certainly do.
And I will get around to them when I wrap up my analysis of my findings. And so all of these corporations benefited from put option tradings. And apparently, I mean, it was 100-to-1 gamble, you know, on Wall Street by different hedge fund developers. And they basically gambled if the stock is going to fall. And win 100-to-1 bet gamble, and corporations like Lougheed and Raytheon, and L3 Communications, these wartime military arsenal development companies stood to gain from an increase in a war in Iraq or Afghanistan or in the Middle East per se. Now, coupled with the fact that with this put option stock trading and the gamble, I said I began to wonder, well, how long is it going to take? Why did the SEC, right, then deputize hundreds of different people in the department, deputize them to investigate 9/11 put option stock tradings, but what happened then is the SEC refused to release its findings. Well, by deputizing all of their employees, that made them liable for not being able to put out to the public any information around the investigation. Simultaneous with that investigation, the FBI and the National Security Associations started investigating, but then all of a sudden there was major suppression around the FBI, and there was major suppression of the National Security Agency to investigating the those who traded put option stocks. Now, they had up to 100 people that initially in the beginning of their investigation that they were investigating, Americans, and then they stopped their investigations, quoting, stating that the reason that they stopped the investigation is because they could be sued by Americans for investigating Americans. Well, now, when was any intelligence agency of the United States, both domestic and abroad, right, interested in, worried about being sued for any internal investigation? So what we had there, what I've seen, was a blatant cover-up. And as far as I was concerned, I had to go back and ask myself, well, I was reading another article by a guy by the name of Bill Bergen, from the Chicago Board of Exchange, and I was wondering, he himself was investigating the put option trades that were traded out, and there was a large volume of trades traded out of Chicago, and he basically stated that he had been suppressed by the Federal Reserve in New York from investigating, and the SEC from investigating the put options stocks that were traded. Then, of course, we had the 9/11 Commission later on that was saying, yeah, well, it's true that these stocks were traded, but it was insignificant to the findings of the whitewash commission, the 9/11 commission. So anyways, so I began to say, well, somebody with influential power was suppressing all of these established intelligence networks and agencies, as well as individuals within these agencies, from investigating, and it looked like the only person, you know, and I had to ask myself, well, you know, who was behind the New York, Federal Reserve? Who owns the Federal Reserve? So I Googled that in, and sure enough, a very slick graphic chart came up of two families that owned the Federal Reserve, and that was the Rothschild families from the Bank of England in Europe, and as well as the Rockefellers. I thought, isn't this amazing? As I was going through the slick graphics, I've seen a whole list of corporations of both families that they owned the stocks and the corporations they owned. Ironically, but very strategically, at least 25 of those corporations that were listed on their corporate holdings in this chart of who owns the Federal Reserve are also the stocks that were traded to the benefit of the put option stocks around 9/11. So automatically, I link Rothschilds and Rockefellers behind the 9/11 World Trade Center to the controlled demolitions of those buildings. As I go further into my study, I begin to ask myself, well, who owned and who benefited from the Twin Towers? Of course, we both know Lucky Larry Silverstein was one of the owners of the Twin Tower complex. And another corporation that helped secure the initial lease of the Twin Towers from the New York or the New Jersey Port Authority was the Blackstone Corporation. I started doing research on Blackstone Corporation and found out that Blackstone was started by a guy by the name of Steven Schwartzman and Peter Peterson. And Blackstone had put up $111 million to Larry Silverstein's $14 million to purchase the Twin Towers. This was weeks, right? This was weeks before in the initial purchase of the towers. As I was critiquing Blackstone, who they were, I found out that they were a consortium of different insurance companies, and that in that consortium, I found out that Peter Peterson had a direct tie with Maurice Greenberg of the AIG, American International Group. Now, American International Group, as I later find out, plays predominantly behind this fiasco, the 9/11 fiasco. And the way I read it and the way I've seen it, through my research, what I basically saw coincided with some research that had been done by a group out in San Diego called the San Diego Citizens Inquiry. And there was a grand jury that was held by these citizens who basically had also identified Peter Peterson, Maurice Hank Greenberg, and Rudy Giuliani and a bunch of other people as being behind 9/11. further research goes to show that Blackstone Corporation is owned by Nathan Rothschild and a number of different Chinese corporations. It then goes into that Blackstone also owns Blackwater, which is a mercenary group that we've heard so much about in their activities of killing innocent Iraqis, not only just 17 in Iraq, which they're being under investigation for right now, but they also killed hundreds and hundreds in their mercenary quest for the oil of Iraq. On behalf of Bush, Cheney, and the Rockefeller-Rothschild connections. So going further into my study, I find out that George Soros was one of the persons, along with Henry Kissinger, who had worked with Blackstone, on the board of Blackstone, to help Blackstone secure leases through the pipelines in Afghanistan through the Bush-Cheney administration. And in doing so, it began to become clear to me that it would become very convenient in order to have these various corporate figures, predominantly I'm calling it the syndicated family of the Federal Reserve System. And in doing so, what I found out is that these people had a vested interest on a number of fronts to orchestrate the bringing down the falling of the Twin Towers in order to justify an incursion into Iraq relative to the whole strategy laid out from the grand chessboard written by Zbigniew Brzezinski. And if you read further, the child that gave the written child that was given birth out of that was called the Project for a New American Century, which was laid out devising a political strategy for the 21st century, written predominantly by people like Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and many different neocons that worked in the Bush administration on behalf of Israel's interest. Now, having read that and seen that in the Project for New American Century basically stated without any qualms that the way that that U.S. financial and military interest would be met in the next century, predominantly the oil and gas interest worldwide, predominantly in the Middle East, would be done. But there would be a need to deploy to the Middle East and create a theater of wars in order to seize control of those oil and gas installations and pipelines worldwide. So in doing that, they said that the only way that they could gain support of the American public would be to create a situation, a cataclysmic event like that of a Pearl Harbor, like that which was done in Pearl Harbor in 1942. So what we have is you got the Bush administration, predominantly the Cheney, who was heading the Energy Department and the Energy Group. What you had basically is that they were devising a plan. They needed a justification to go into the Mideast to seize Iraq's oil as well as the gas and oil pipelines of Afghanistan. And that's not to forget the fact they also wanted to seize control of the drug fields, the heroin markets, the opium markets. So putting all this together, I did more research on American International Group and Maurice Greenberg, and found out that there was a person by the name of Richard Andrew Grove. Have you heard of him, read about him?
Yes, indeed. I believe he runs the Eighth Estate website.
Yes, he does. Now, if you read in the Eighth Estate website, if you read a position paper he's got called Project Constellation, if you go to www.eighthestate.com and read the Project Constellations is 31 pages of information. He basically states that he was working for Jeffrey Greenberg, who is the son of Maurice Greenberg, in one of the corporations there in the Twin Towers. And he was a developer of software that allowed, and he wasn't aware of what his software was doing, but was creating a backdoor for AIG to funnel hundreds of millions of dollars of fraudulent insurance scam money into accounts in the Cayman Islands and on international levels into Switzerland and the like. Now, what he says is that he didn't realize that that he was creating this backdoor for them, and he had been brought this up because he was getting all kinds of perks and stuff and commissions for what he was doing, and so when he went and told his boss that that he in fact was getting paid too much. And that he's always thought he was getting paid too much, and that he was when he realized that he was creating this backdoor for all the scams, the financial scams that was going on internationally. He then tells them in a written report that that he basically is didn't want to participate in cooking books and running Money's Man through software that he had created. Because he felt they probably could be at some point, if there was ever an investigation and indictments brought down, he could be indicted himself. Well, when they heard this, they automatically, his boss had him fired. And as they had him fired, they also, man, started messing with his bank accounts. They started messing with future employees. They made life very rough for him and his wife, to the point where they were sleeping out of friends' apartments and basically, basically sold most of their assets in order to just stay above water to survive in New York. That said, he then goes on to say that he gets a call from the boss, from his boss, and his boss, his former boss, and the boss said he wants to rehire him and wanted him to bring all of his papers back to the 98th floor of the North Tower on September the 11th. Now, he says it just coincidentally, he says, and by some fate of destiny, to his benefit, he got caught in traffic and was like a half hour to 40 minutes late getting to the meeting. Now, fortunately, if he had gone to that meeting and met with all of the other employees of that of the company, and that was Marshall McLellan, and he was scheduled to be at that meeting, and his boss was going to call in a teleconference, but he didn't make it, and that's when the plane hit the 98th floor in the room where they were supposed to be. In other words, they attempted to kill him. They knew that that is where the room where he was going to be. AIG was definitely implicated in $100 million fraudulent scam, and 9/11 became a bonanza for insurance scams on that day. Now, this is by his own, I'm as living my perspective, but I'm giving you the stats that he would have been in that floor with that meeting with Marshall McLellan, which was one of the beneficiaries of the put option stocks on 9/11.
Absolutely, and I suggest that my listeners do check out Richard Grove's website, and also he did a podcast for a while. I'm not sure if that's still going, but certainly at 8thestate.com. Splitting the Sky, you've gone through an incredible amount of detail there and a lot of different connections. Earlier on, you mentioned Jerome Hauer. Could you introduce Jerome Hauer to those out there who maybe haven't heard of him before?
Well, Jerome Hauer, basically, as I know he headed the Office of Emergency Management, which was a bunker that was created by Rudy Giuliani on the 23rd floor of the World Trade Center number 7. Now, the reason I mention Hauer is because I believe that he's highly implicated along with the Federal Reserve crime family as being totally implicated. He was also He was also the head of Kroll Security, which was the security agency used under WTC-7 and the Twin Towers. And so Kroll was eventually bought up by American International Group, by Maurice Greenberg. Maurice Hank Greenberg is his nickname there. And Jeffrey Greenberg. So the Greenberg family buys up Kroll in order to keep a cap on all the investigation was done. Now, Jerome Howard, along with Rudy Giuliani, were also had also orchestrated what was known as Operation Tripod. Operation Tripod was supposed to be effected on September the 12th, 2001, the day after 9/11 attack. And what I saw that was the cleanup mop-up operation. What the Operation Tripod was a mock cleanup operation after an attack. It was supposed to be a biological attack hit New York City. And what they were supposed to do is they were supposed to go through a mock routine as if New York had been attacked by a biological weapon, and there were hundreds of FEMA agents that were in town in New York on the 10th of September, though they denied it in their commission hearings, 9/11 commission report. And I know for a fact that there were hundreds of FEMA agents, because when I was in the Marriott Financial World Trade Center number 1 with my family, we've seen hundreds of FEMA agents milling around in that building. Now, before I left on the 10th, so they were actually there by the night or the 9th, because I remember seeing them there that night we got back from that benefit concert I talked to you about earlier. In any event, what I see this Operation Tripod, all these FEMA agents were in under the guise of being there under a mock emergency operation. I think they were there under the guise of an emergency operation, a cleanup operation for a biological attack, when in reality they knew that they were going to fall those buildings and 3,000 people were going to die. And Rudy Giuliani, his job was to make sure, right, that the command center, which was bomb-proof, wind-proof, and every other kind of proof, allowed those planes to be guided in through remote control, to be taken commandeered through different software computer systems, security systems, software that Michael Rupert spoke about in his book, Crossing the Rubicon. And when those planes had hit their targets, that they would then implode building number 7, WTC-7, in order to destroy all the evidence that was housed in there, the SEC and the NSA and other about the whole question of the put option stocks that were traded, you know, prior to 9/11. So then when they blew those buildings, then the operations, the cleanup team would get there, they would set up an immediate security team, FEMA would, and they would cordon the place off, and they wouldn't allow any investigators from the outside to come in and look at the crime scene. As a matter of fact, they took various companies over there, demolition companies that were brought in to do the cleanup, to get all of the waste, all of the building that was demolished, all the steel, everything collected and taken to landfills and eventually shipped out to China and India. And, of course, that metal was melted down to become warships. They become a major warship. Now, the thing about it was is that he got in the way of a criminal investigation. Now, Rudy Giuliani was a former district attorney of Manhattan, and he should have, I think it was the Second Circuit, district attorney. But in any event, he, as a former prosecutor, should have known that they should establish those police lines, and all of that material would have been analyzed to see if there were explosives used during the demolition of those buildings. That crime scene should have been kept intact, contingent upon teams of legal experts and criminal investigators to come in there and research and look at that crime scene in order to come up with an initial report as to how those buildings came down. So while people are looking at the top planes flying into the buildings, there is a number of accounts that those buildings were blown up from the base, and heard massive explosions, and we know that there was the Sims Corporation that had offices on the 17th floor that broke its $50,000 lease, left that building, and there was eyewitness accounts that tons of explosives were brought into the 17th floor where the Sims building was. Sims, by the way, along with the urban moving companies where the five dancing Israelis were seen and were stopped on the George Washington Bridge with explosives in their van, were Israeli Mossad operatives. And both Sims and urban moving companies were Mossad operational fronts. Now, Jerome Howard was affiliated with Kroll, overseeing the bringing in of those explosives in and setting up explosive charges inside of the Twin Towers.
Well, for my listeners out there who haven't heard of him before, Jerome Howard is also a building collapse specialist. He was also, as you say, on CBS News with Dan Rather on the morning of 9/11, saying that the towers must have come down due to jet fuel. And he was also advising the White House staff to go on Cipro, the anti-anthrax drug, on the morning of 9/11. So he was a very busy individual on that day.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
And he also got his friend, John O'Neill, hired as head of World Trade Center security. And one of his first days on the job, of course, was 9/11. John O'Neill being the former head of counterterrorism in the FBI and a person who resigned in disgust at the way the Bush administration shut down his investigation into bin Laden. So Jerome Howard seems to be one of those nexus points in which a lot of these connections come to light. Two good sources for people to find more information on that is a documentary, or a movie, I should say, entitled Who Killed John O'Neill, which has a lot of the same information that Richard Grove also covers. And of course, I would suggest that people take a look at Splitting the Skies information on your website, which we'll get into in a moment. But moving ahead, Splitting the Sky, let's talk about some of your activism and some of the work that you've done to get this information out to other people. I understand you were one of the speakers in Ottawa on 9/11 last year, attempting to deliver a petition to Parliament asking them to investigate 9/11. Were you part of the truth bus that went out to 9/11?
No, I know the fellows and the folks that went from the Vancouver region, Vancouver 9/11 Truth. We Are Change, and they drove across. I teamed up with a very active progressive person by the name of Wayne, who organizes out of 9/11 the Fraser Rally Truth, 9/11 Truth, and I teamed up with him, and he and I flew out there to Ottawa and gave both of us gave talks, which is on our site, www.splittingthesky.net.
Tell us about your experience in Ottawa.
Well, I think it was sort of a coalition of people that the Montreal 9/11 Truth, the Ottawa 9/11 Truth, 9/11 Truthers, maybe during the whole day, about maybe a couple hundred people came together to demand that Ottawa investigate 9/11, to create an investigation, a commission around what really happened at 9/11. From a Canadian perspective, we were wondering why Canada refuses to investigate what happened to the 24 Canadians that were killed on that day. And so there was a number of speakers that came together that day and gave speeches out in front of Parliament to demand an investigation into 9/11.
I hear you have some activism planned for the near future in Calgary. Tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, George Bush intends to, has been invited by the Calgary Chamber of Commerce, as well as the a law firm by the name of Bennett Jones to attend a luncheon. And the media has been the media is not allowed to record or even attend a luncheon. I believe it's a very expensive luncheon. 1,500 people will be there at $400 a plate. I have done right now. I am trying to coordinate a serious action in conjunction with my lawyer, Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General of the United States. I'm waiting for a position paper from him in conjunction with work being done by Gail Davidson of the Lawyers Against War, based out of Vancouver. prominent peoples from the Calgary area, the Unitarian Church, and people that belong to that Unitarian Church, a friend of mine named John and Ed, that are helping to help organize this this anti-Bush demonstration. We're basically saying George Bush and Cheney, Bush and company, committed war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that they created the greatest, that they were behind 9/11, and in doing so, they manufactured 9/11 to justify an incursion into the Mideast in Iraq and Afghanistan. The company, now that isn't, may not be the total position of Ramsey Clark and or Gail Davidson from the law offices, but from those of us that are affiliated with the 9/11 Truth Movement, we know that the intent behind these illegal occupations and genocidal occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan were the work of those behind the scenes we've already named. We intend to create a big welcoming party and condemn Bush for the war crimes, for the thousands of people who have died because of this manufactured manufactured war from this the real crimes committed at 9/11. We intend to expose and expose what really happened behind 9/11. And to demand that elected officials in Ottawa as well as the provincial levels refuse access of Bush into this country for war crimes committed out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And that includes the torture, that includes the killings by the Blackwater teams, the murders committed by Blackwater, that includes the justification of torture by John Woo and the Bush team, and it includes, you know, all of the, it includes dealing with the fact that we're also going to be calling attention to this Bennett Jones, who represent this law firm represents the interest of Husky Oil and Terrasen Gas in British Columbia, as well as in Petro-Canada. We're going to be profiling and critiquing their interests there for sponsoring Bush and his oil interests, not only in Iraq and Afghanistan, but worldwide, but also over here in Canada in the tar sands. What we're saying is what they've done in their interest, creating 9/11 for their interest in pipelines internationally. We're also saying that, they have to stop this in the tar sands in Alberta immediately, because it's in violation of international and constitutional law relative to, the claims of the Lubicon people, the Lubicon Cree, who have never surrendered this territory. So the same law firm that is representing or is inviting Bush in for this conference in Calgary is also the same law firm that is illegally representing Kerrison, Husky, and Petro-Canada in the Trans-Canada pipeline that goes from British Columbia into the tar sands of southern Alberta.
Well, there's no doubt that this is going to be an important opportunity for the truth community in Western Canada to make their voice heard and potentially get even a national or international stage for their message. So, of course, I would encourage all of my listeners in my hometown of Calgary and my friends at Calgary 911 Truth to get involved in this action. If people want to find out more information about this, where can they go?
They should give me a call right now and call me at area code 250-679-7743 or my cell number 371-0562 and or else go to www.splittingthesky.net and you can get my website, you can get my email address, splittingthesky@yahoo.com and contact me because we certainly need as much assistance as we can in order to make that day happen. And I am glad to report that to you, James, that I am diligently working in solidarity with the 9/11 Calgary group there. And I do suspect and expect that there will be a very high visible presence. And that's what there will be, what will happen on March the 17th will be heard internationally.
Well, that's excellent news. I know that Nathan Moulton out of Calgary 911 Truth does some excellent work, and we've had him on the program a couple of times now. So I'm looking forward.
Yes, and I'm working directly with Nathan, and he will be documenting it, and it will go up on Yahoo and Google.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to that for sure. All right, Splitting the Sky, finally today, we've talked about a number of issues, but trying to draw this together, today on the Corbett Report, of course, we're discussing the terrible travesty, the genocide that has taken place in the Canadian residential school system over the past several decades, and the terrible pain that and trauma that's been inflicted on the Native peoples of Canada. And of course, your activism is one of those rays of hope that we can take out of such terrible tragedy, and I'd like to hear you speak to the idea of taking a terrible tragedy like the institutionalized nature of the system that has oppressed Native peoples, and taking that anger and putting it into positive constructive activism towards building a better society.
Well, you know, that is it's a very deep-rooted thing there, James, that you posed to me here. And of course, it has very personal implications. You know, every time I think about residential schools, I think about the many nights I laid inside of my cots and I listened to young Native boys and girls, laying in their bed in the dormitory at night, and then all of a sudden, you know, you hear the screams of young boys or young girls being ripped off sexually and attacked. And then you look at the horror of the situation and how people were beaten, their hair cut off, and then their tongues, needles put through our tongues and taped up and our mouths taped up and thrown into closets for days at times. It was a form of torture that was produced on young, innocent children that were just literally taken from our homes and put into these institutions. And when you think about the kind of abuse that went on there, and then you think about years down the road, you know, that all of these atrocities, and even the murders and killings of young kids, young children that were in these schools, and having to fight to come through it in order to talk about it today. And I think about all those families that lost children this way, and that the many children, thousands and thousands of children that were sexually brutalized and beaten physically, and that the kind of horror that these people still live with to today, and that the stories are horrible, horror stories beyond belief. And And then you see that kind of sexual abuse and that sexual aggression and attack and the sort of predators that have been created that have gone back into their communities and done almost the identical things that were done to them. And then, of course, there were a lot of people that went through the healing, through the sweat lodge and ceremonies to find their way back and to release that from themselves, to become a better, stronger person, to become a human being again, to find their way home, to find their own souls, their own spiritual nature. You know, it. You know, you can go through that kind of and you can carry those kind of experiences with you, and you can become a very bitter and a hard person, and you can do the same things that that the oppressor did, that did this to you. Or you can take from that experience and you can then dismiss it through ceremony into the world of spirit and say to yourself, you know, but this, I don't own this, because this is something that was done to me. So I am just throwing this back into the wind because I don't own this and I can't carry this with me because it's destroying me from within. So rather than allow that to destroy me from within, I'm going to get past that and I'm going to become the kind of person that I want to be, that is in accordance with what I believe is natural law. And that is to become a person that is a positive, loving human being, and that we can build together against this form of system and this form of apartheid and this form of atrocities that are committed from these systems that are not good to indigenous people. But then again, we also have to realize, too, in our search and our research and for understanding why these things are done. I was surprised to find out in my research on residential schools and boarding schools that this same kind of process happened to thousands, hundreds of thousands of Europeans in Great Britain. So it's not only indigenous, but it was carried over from Great Britain. It was done to the to white people in Europe before it was done to us. So it is something that we have to understand, that this form of dehumanizing process that was done systemically through sexual and physical abuse was done in order to make us willing subjects, man, to an authoritarian regime that only seeks, man, to continue its interest in class, its class interest. We've got to do away with class interests. We've got to identify the real criminals, like the federal. We got to outlaw the Federal Reserve System or the Federal Reserve Crime Family Syndicate. We have to get back to our roots, and we got to be able to understand that some very heavy earth change is coming soon. Prophecies have foreseen a very hard time in the time that we're in right now. We had better get ourselves together and get realigned, man, with natural law before we're all obliterated by unnatural occurrences. You know, I remember reading years ago the prophecies of Daganoweda, and it was talking about, you know, the necessity to intervene on the sort of things right now. We even saw that 9/11 situation and the murders of 3,000 innocent souls that are crying out for justice right now. And then the prophecies of Daganoweda talks about the return of the visionary of the Iroquois people at this time right here. He said, well, all these catastrophes were beginning to happen. He said that all of a sudden, he said that there would be this, you know, there would be this war between the red serpent and the white serpent, symbolizing capitalist and communist type nations, and that would start at sea. And that when these nations, it would start out in a low-heated battle, and then eventually it would get so hot, it would escalate into, you know, to a war. The battle would cause the oceans to boil and the fish to turn on their stomachs and the trees to burn from the top down, and bugs of unbelievable creatures would come from the cracks in the earth because the earth was so hot. Well, what Daganoweda was describing was a nuclear war, and it's important to understand now that you have to understand that many of those people that were in the Federal Reserve that I'm talking about, the financiers, these same financiers like the Rothschilds, Rockefellers, Soros, Brzezinski's, all these people are the same people that financed Obama's administration's presidential campaign. And Obama has an interest, man. It's not a coincidence that we've escalated, that he's escalated the troops into Afghanistan by 17,000 because they intend to seize that pipeline. And they intend to get it before Russia gets it, as well as establishing the military defense system. This could cause for that, which Duganowita saw, that this battle that would begin slow and it would intensify and take us into a nuclear situation. A nuclear war, World War III. And this is the reason why I'm so intent on doing what I'm doing, because I have children that have to come through this time. I got young children. I believe that that the reason why it's so important for 9/11 truthers to expose 9/11 as an inside false flag operation on par with that which was done with the sinking of the Lufthansa, bringing the U.S. into Britain's war with Germany, as well as the sinking of the USS Liberty, which in the Six-Day War, and many other false flag operations that have happened throughout history. And the reason that it was done, the reason that it's important for us to expose 9/11 as an inside job, is in order to intervene on the progression towards a nuclear war. And the only way this unbridled war on terror, even though the Obama administration basically is stating that the war on terror has ended, it has not ended. It cannot end if you're putting 17,000 more troops and three battalions into Afghanistan to secure a pipeline that's going to trigger an international incident. I wonder to myself, in closing, how could these people cause so many casualties, millions of people dying and being murdered in this wave of what's happening, and the worst is yet to come? How could all of this happen unless, in fact, somebody at the higher end of the echelons understands that something else is coming? And I remember Duganowita saying that at the time when all of this fury begins to happen in this world, he said, when this begins to happen, the people will be blindsided by a resilient ball in the sky, a light in the sky. And then I thought to myself, geez, what could that light be in this prophecy? And then it hit me. It hit me about this thing that is supposed to be passing through the Earth here within the next couple of years. It's a thing called Planet X, the planet Nibiru. We better look at that soon. Because that's the only thing in my mind that could justify for the power elite to say to themselves, well, you know, we allow so many millions and millions of people's man to go down and planned, consorted, or unplanned and unconsorted population depopulation control or depopulation process. And so what I'm thinking that there is going to be this great upheaval going through with this planet going through, and one would need to look at that in order to understand the prophecies, the fulfilling of prophecies coming through right now. So I just add that in there because this is the way I see it from an indigenous perspective.
Splitting the Sky, it's been an incredible talk with you today, and we've covered so much information, and so much of what you've said is absolutely vital. So I certainly hope that my listeners have taken it to heart. And I'd really like to talk to you again in the future and talk to you about some of your activism again in the future. So I hope you'll join us again. But for those listeners who want to find out more about you in the meantime, please give out your website one more time.
Okay, it's www.splittingthesky.net. And you can also call me or you can write me at email me, splittingthesky@yahoo.com. And then the telephone number is 250-679-7743, as well as my cell, 371-0562. Please call. We need assistance. We need help organizing this. We need you to help and contribute towards this effort. Give me a call, and I appreciate hearing from everybody and anybody.
All right. Well, we appreciate hearing from you and Splitting the Sky. Thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today.
And thank you very much, James, for the service that you provide.